Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to KPCW. It's time for Erica Martin from the ABC Forecast Center. She's on the line to give us an update on our weather forecast. Good morning.
Good morning, Caroline. Good morning, everybody. Park City. Temperatures for today climbing into the mid-80s, so you're going to have a great day in the forecast. We're starting off with mostly sunny skies. We'll eventually mix out seeing sunny skies. And the breezes for today, I'm super happy about because they're going to be very calm with a northwesterly component. So a nice, I'd say, ideal summer day. Now, by Thursday, we're going to see a little bump up in those temperatures. 85 is your expected high. And it looks like we could be perhaps a little bit of some moisture seeping in, and we could squeeze out one or two isolated showers. Now, I won't exclude the chance of a convective pop-up shower later in the afternoon, so just keep that in mind. But overall, it's going to be a mainly dry day. It's not until the afternoon hours we'll get some daytime heating, and we'll get some processes that will lead to some isolated thunderstorms. Now, on Friday, we could top out at 89 degrees, a very hot day, and looks like it might be the hottest day of this week, and the breezes will start to increase a little bit, so just be mindful there of any fire weather concerns. Saturday, we'll see a high of 88, and we'll see mostly sunny skies. By Sunday, I'm going to increase cloud coverage there, and even though it's going to remain hot, we're going to see 86 as a high. It looks like we could see mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies. We start the following work week with a nice warm start, 85, and mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies, increasing clouds by Tuesday. So I think it's a very nice stretch, with the exception of those isolated showers later tomorrow, possibly one or two isolated thunderstorms. We mainly remain dry. Unfortunately, that isn't going to be measurable precip, so we're not going to see an improvement as far as our drought monitor is concerned. Be mindful of the fact that Summit County, you are still under very dry conditions as far as the drought monitor is concerned, and those breezes remain light, so at least that looks good. Have a great day. Enjoy your summer Wednesday.
Thank you, Erica.
Thank you.
That's Erica Martin. She is the ABC Forecast Center meteorologist. Well, stay tuned for the mountain life coming up this morning at 9 a.m. right after NPR News and our local news hour. Pete and Lynn's guests include Gary John Bishop, who is one of the leading personal development experts in the industry, making change in our lives, how to move past grief, how we find meaning and good relationships. Gary will talk about this with an entertaining twist. Then renowned psychiatrist and avid gardener Sue Stewart-Smith, the well-gardened mind, the restorative power of nature, is an inspiring and deeply researched exploration of the healing effects of gardening and the long-lasting mental health benefits that come from immersing oneself in the natural world. And just a reminder, roadwork on Bonanza Drive has closed that intersection at Kearns Boulevard, SR-248, while crews complete the work on a transmission waterline improvement project. So please plan accordingly, use alternate routes, slow down, pay attention to the flaggers out there. And this work will go through Thursday evening. Last week, Midway City Council heard a brief conversation regarding a request to make some upgrades and changes to the Homestead Resort. KPCW's David Boyle has more on this.
Plans to revitalize the Homestead Resort in Midway have been a topic of conversation for the past year and a half. Last year, a local company's plan to purchase and revitalize the Homestead Resort were stalled when the company and one of the property owners within the resort were unable to resolve a title issue. Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson explains the new investment group behind the Homestead hopes to update the master plan approved in 2008.
They were hoping to be able to make these changes without having to go through a lot of the preliminary and be in front of the planning committee. Mission, et cetera, et cetera. We've looked at the plan. We believe there are elements of it that they can proceed with without any problem, but that there are certain other elements that we do need to take a deeper dive.
The council decided to take an in-depth look at the plans for the Homestead at an upcoming work meeting. Items to review included a possible amphitheater and a barn that could be used for weddings and other events. While the city works out the details on those parts of the plan, Johnson says the investment group will be able to start working soon on some parts of the project.
Kind of remodel modeling things, things that don't dramatically change anything. I understand that they're hoping to work on the golf course all through the winter. So come spring, those new buildings will be ready and the golf course will be ready. Obviously, that golf course is a jewel and it's needed a lot of work as well.
City staff reports the update to the master plan would not increase density while providing 62 acres of open space. Additional findings shared by the staff included that the project will increase the tax base and help the city comply with resort tax requirements, which require a certain ratio of short-term rooms to residences.
We're actually very excited about this project. We feel like it's a good project for Midway. It's a good project for the Homestead. I think everybody agrees that the Homestead has gotten a little tired and it needs a shot of good old currency to bring it back up, and that's what this group will do.
After going through a work meeting, the item will return again to the City Council for approval. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
It's 8:12. This is KPCW's Morning Local News Hour, and on the line I have Nick Francis. He's an exercise physiologist at the Live Well Center at the Park City Hospital. He's joining us here on the phone to talk about the programs the center is offering, and it appears that there are both now in-person and virtual programs. Good morning, Nick. Thank you for joining us. Well, let's have you try calling back.
Oh, there we go. You know what? I can hear you better now.
Okay, great. Well, as I said, Nick, you're an exercise physiologist at the Live Well Center. Thank you for joining us this morning. Mm-hmm. Why don't you give us a little bit of a background on your job at the center and what you are offering to the clients or patients that come to you?
Yeah, so I'm an exercise physiologist, as you mentioned, at the Live Well Center in Park City. And part of my job is not only teaching, you know, exercise classes and personal training, but also screening patients who come in to put them into appropriate treatments or exercise classes or movement routines to help them improve strength, flexibility, mobility, balance, and just depending on where they're at in their life or what injuries they may be going through, to help them live their best life possible and to physically train them so that they're able to do so.
And what age ranges do you work with? Are you working with children as well as elderly?
We really have no limit on age range. We work with, you know, minors all the way up to people who are in their 80s, sometimes even into their 90s. There's really no limit there. We're open to the public generally, and there's really no limitations to who we'll work with and train.
Okay, and typically are people who are coming to you, have they had some kind of a occurrence, an accident, some illness, they've been, you know, in the hospital, that type of thing, or is it also broader and expands into just people who are looking for a personalized fitness program?
Yeah, you know what, it's really a whole variety of different types of people. Some people are just being discharged from physical therapy for a joint replacement. Some people have recently been to their primary care physician who has said, you know, you're diabetic or you have osteopenia. I would like you to start to exercise more, eat better. And a lot of times they'll refer them to us to help them, you know, navigate that path. And there are quite a few people who come to us who are very healthy, very active, and they just want access to the expertise that we can give them that they may have had trouble finding elsewhere.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your programs that are offered there.
Sure. So we have really a pretty large variety of programs that we can offer people. Typically, what we ask people to do is to go through our functional fitness assessment. Now, this is a screening program that helps us to put the patient through a variety of different movements and to see how they move through those movements. This helps us identify any dysfunction or weakness or lack of balance. And from there, we take that information and we help to place them in the appropriate class. So we have classes for people who just have difficulty getting around. So our Build Me Up class would kind of be our entry-level class. This is a class that is seated, and we do resistance training from a seated position. So this would be, you know, designed for people who have difficulty walking around. Maybe they use a walking assistance device like a cane or a walker. And then we have all the way up to very high level Live Fit Plus, which would be high intensity strength and conditioning. And we have everything in between. So if someone, you know, is able to ambulate pretty well, they're walking around, but they're concerned for their balance and their mobility and their strength. We have a class that's actually called Balance and Mobility, and this focuses on people who have either self-identified who have been warned, you know, you're at a pretty moderate to high risk fall. We want you to focus on improving your balance and your strength so that we can reduce that risk of a fall. Or if you do lose your balance, you're more likely to be able to collect yourself and catch yourself before you actually fall and injure yourself. So we have everything from seated classes all the way up to something that an elite level athlete could participate in.
And are the classes offered in person? I mean, with the distancing that we're trying to practice and mask wearing, those kinds of things, how are these classes offered right now?
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up. So right now we're not offering any classes in the LiveWell Center because of the issues, you know, with COVID, and we want to be able to keep people safe. So we have all of these classes are now available virtually. And just to give you an idea of what that would look like. So we can do this functional fitness assessment that I just mentioned virtually, and it's a one-time $50 fee. It helps us get you in the right class. And once you're into that initial class, we could actually move you around based on your needs. If you improve, we could move you up. If you're noticing more difficulty, we could regress you to something that just better addresses the issues that you have. So once you've had that functional fitness exam, we have two options for our MoveWell classes. So we have a $45 a month option, and that gives you access to two classes per week. And that could be any of those classes. You could mix and match, you know, the balance and mobility, something that's a little bit lighter intensity, but is focusing on moving better and more confidently. You could pair that with a LiveFit class, which would be a little bit more focused on strength and conditioning, or you could do two of the same. This also gives you access to unlimited virtual yoga and mindfulness living and meditation. So our two packages that we offer are $45, which is the one I just mentioned. That's two classes per month, unlimited yoga, unlimited mindful living, and mindfulness meditation. The second option is $70, which is unlimited to everything that we offer as far as the virtual classes. So that would be, you could go to a virtual MoveWell class every day. It could be the same one. It could be a variety. We're open Monday through Friday, and we run these classes basically between 7 in the morning and 1 in the afternoon. So you have a lot of options to attend a class that best fits your schedule.
And is someone holding the class online and it's being anchored out of wherever it's streaming from, or how will that work? How do people, you know, access it?
Yeah, so we are running the classes right now through WebEx. So it's accessed virtually. Each of us, the exercise physiologists, we all have our own personal meeting room in WebEx. And what we do is we send out an email with a list of all the classes that we offer. And then from there, you just click on a link to the class that you want to attend, and it takes you right to the personal room of the physiologist who is leading that class. So it's really user-friendly, and it's really easy to access. We teach from different locations. Sometimes we're at the clinic itself. Other times we're teaching outside or from our own homes. So it's easy for us to get to you. It's easy for you to see us and participate. And most of the classes we use require little to no equipment.
Okay. And what kinds of things are you seeing with the COVID isolation and people sort of staying home and not really socializing much? Have you noticed any kind of overall sense of how people's wellness and their physical health is, that type of thing?
You know, it's a little bit different for everyone. But some of the things I've noticed, a lot of people will joke around that since COVID started, they've put on, you know, 5 pounds, 10 pounds sometimes. And I think a lot of that comes from they don't realize the resources that they have access to. And that's a big part of the reason why we wanted to do this interview with you today, was to let people know, even if, you know, you're not feeling confident in going out and exposing yourself, you know, to a lot of person-to-person interaction while this pandemic is spreading, you can stay fit, you can stay healthy from your own home or from a place that you choose. I mean, you could take your phone to a park and join us in one of these classes. So one of the things I think is people are nervous to rightfully so, to go out and to intermix with people. But I think a lot of that is they don't realize that these options are available for them.
Yeah. Okay. And how would someone find out more about this? Where would they go to learn about it?
It's really as simple. If you go to Google and you just type in Intermountain and Live Well, we will be the first link that pops up on that search. And the other point I wanted to make, too, is that not only are we offering these virtual class options, but in the clinic, we are able to do therapeutic massage and acupuncture. So there are some limitations there to who we can see. There are certain, like, for example, therapeutic massage, we're not encouraging prenatal massage at this point, just for the safety of the mother and her child. But we're doing 30-minute therapeutic massage, and it's really for focused body work or medical massage. So those are some things that we're focusing on there. And then acupuncture, there are really no restrictions with acupuncture as far as who can come in. So I just wanted to make sure that, you know, people knew maybe you're injured, or maybe there's something going on that might prevent you from taking one of these classes where you may be nervous that you may injure yourself worse. We have options for you to come in and start to get well by starting that healing process in a way that is going to be conducive and help you to get back on your feet as fast as possible.
Okay, great. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, we would just love to get, you know, the word out that Live Well Center is open to the public. We offer a great range of services, and I would challenge, you know, people looking for somewhere to train or someone to train with, find a more qualified facility that cares genuinely about the well-being of all the people who join us, either in person or virtually, to improve their personal well-being.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's Nick Francis, exercise physiologist at the Live Well Center in the Park City Hospital. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Kale.
Good morning. It's 8:27. It's the local news hour. Next on the line, I have Park City Deputy Manager David Everett. He's here to talk this morning, give us a preview of the council meeting tomorrow. David, thanks for joining us. And so active transportation is on the agenda with a discussion about the remaining funds from the 2007 walkability bond. Now, not calling it walkability anymore, but active transportation. And there was a task force that was put in place, an implementation team. They were assigned to make the recommendations to the council on top priority walkability projects. And all but about $4 million was spent. And the remaining money has been put aside to address the Snow Creek to the Jans and Cole Sport intersection. And it used to be called the Dans to Jans corridor. Of course, Dans is no longer that. It is the market at Snow Creek, the market at Park City. But a lot has changed in the 12 years since the bond passed. What obligations does the city have to those original recommendations made, you know, 10 years ago?
Yeah, thank you, Carolyn. It's good to be with you. Yes, that was a 2007 bond issue. I think it was for about $15 million, like you said. I think we actually now, with interest having accumulated over the years, have closer to $5 million, which is nice to have maybe a little bit more. And yes, a study was done after that bond money, that bond was approved, and a committee subsequently made recommendations based on that study. And it's been a little while. And as you said, things have changed. At the same time, there are still priorities that are within that document that I think remain. So we're really taking this to the council to have a check-in with them and say, you know, it's been a while since we've talked about the funds that are available, and do you want to continue on the path of where they were being prioritized previously, or is it should we refine that and evaluate some other options? For instance, you're right that Dan's Jans area still has some improvements that need to be made. That crossing at Snow Creek, in particular, in Kearns, is just really a problematic one. You just see people playing Frogger on that at that intersection all the time. So we're really hoping to have the council give us some broad policy direction on where they want to go with these projects, and then we can come back with more details if needed. But I think it's also an opportunity, frankly, to brag a little bit for the city, to brag a little bit about how that money has been spent and the improvements that have been made over the years. I went back and looked at the report from 2007, and it's pretty incredible how much has been done since then. So I think we're really looking forward to having a chance to daylight the progress that's been made thus far.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit, too, because the Arts and Culture District discussion is not happening at this meeting. But can the council authorize or use those funds, that excess fund balance, to cover pedestrian and bike access to the Arts and Culture District, even though that's not necessarily the corridor that it was originally assigned to?
Well, yes. I mean, the short answer is yes, the council can decide how to spend those funds however they want within the parameters of the bond language. And that would, you know, walkability or active transportation improvements at Bonanza and Kearns and in the area of the Arts and Culture District certainly would qualify for that. It's definitely a question that, you know, the council is probably going to be looking at. I know there had been discussions sort of more informally that maybe some of a big chunk of these funds should be spent there for connections across Bonanza, but that was never a formal decision by the council. And so this is an opportunity for them to maybe daylight that discussion a little bit and decide if that's the direction they want to go. And I also want to note that the walkability bond fund is a big piece, but not the only piece of funding, types of funding sources that we have for active transportation projects. So it's really a big piece, but not the only piece of the puzzle in terms of thinking about funding for active transportation across the city.
Yeah. And just one more thing about this whole consideration, you know, if you know employees who work at Colesport or Jance, they could probably tell you daily that they see people nearly being run mowed down at that intersection, at the Jans in the Colesport area. And I didn't, in looking through the staff report, I didn't see any piece of that report that addresses that particular intersection, which I know it's been called a failed intersection as far as traffic and safety, and it is a UDOT jurisdiction. But what needs to be done there, and is the city ready to address it?
Well, you're right. It's clearly a problem area within the city. And I know that in part the construction or the planned construction on 248, the study that was done on 248 a few years ago, along with initial cost estimates for what improvements would have cost to do it right were intimidating. So I think that the city's ready to reevaluate how that project should move ahead in the context of its other active transportation needs.
Okay. So they don't have a specific plan yet. There isn't anything being recommended for addressing
not
that particular intersection.
Correct. Not right now.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the Water Conservation Plan agenda item. And staff is asking council to adopt this plan and authorize it to go on to the state for review. Can you kind of talk about what that means? My understanding is that there needs to be a water conservation plan done every 5 years. So it's been, 6 years, I guess, since Park City has done one.
That's right. It is. It's a state requirement. It's a regular deal. Communities have to do this across the state. The city did receive a little bit of special dispensation to be able to push it out a year. So the 2020 deadline is agreed upon with the state. My understanding is they actually had a backlog of conservation plans that were evaluating. So they gave us a little more time to help everybody's schedules. But we're ready to do that now. It's a great chance to really, again, kind of showcase what progress the city has made over the years towards its water conservation goals. For instance, the report talks about that we're already at 50% less water usage for the average home compared to the year 2000, and that continues to be an improvement that the city focuses on. But right now the big goal is how do we stop or reduce water loss, and you know, leaky pipes, busted infrastructure that happens both at sort of the, the house level or the individual project level and also throughout the system, you know, causes a lot of water loss. And figuring out how we can target our infrastructure projects and our capital improvements to address that concern is a big part of what the Water Conservation Plan talks about.
Okay. And, you know, we've got several very big projects that are, you know, being considered here, the Base Area and the Arts and Culture District. And how do those huge projects weigh into that conservation plan? Because that will start now on the next by the next time we have to submit another water conservation plan.
That's exactly right. And both of those projects are great opportunities to upgrade infrastructure, to ensure that we're putting in, you know, the latest technological features to be able to monitor water use and the potential for leaks. And it really, and also to put in the types of fixtures that really help reduce water and allow for the best level of water use efficiency, you know, particularly in, you know, commercial spaces with hotel rooms, that kind of thing. You're always looking for opportunities to see where you can have better fixtures that'll help you with your water efficiency goals.
Yeah, and in attending the walkthrough of the base last week, one of the questions asked was, do these developments have water, much less conserving water? And is that something that, as part of the process, is considered when you submit this plan?
Whether each development is bringing water capacity to the development?
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that one, Carolyn, honestly. I think that some communities, you see that approach in place, but a lot of communities, particularly in the West, that's not always a requirement. I think that there's an evaluation that's always done by our water utility and our water rights, the people who in the city who deal with water rights, to ensure that we do have capacity. But whether the city requires development to bring water, as it were, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Well, next time we interview, maybe you'll have
that
answer.
Definitely track that down.
Take a note. Hey,
I am.
And one other thing with this. So you mentioned that fixtures and infrastructure. So as part of the approval of these developments, of any project, are those things part of the code and requirements?
They're part of the building code, and sometimes there are even opportunities through negotiation to ask developers to, go above and beyond the standard building code requirements. So if we have opportunities to do that, I know we'll always be looking for those. Those are pretty core in the process for the city in terms of, you know, our sustainability goals.
Okay. And it looks like the issue of cluster mailboxes and whether or not the Main Street Post Office should close and mail delivery should be occurring, you know, more locally in each of the little areas of the neighborhood. Can you talk about what the recommendation is from staff and what you're hoping to hear from the city after this presentation? David, we've got you back on the line.
Oh, good.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened. Just you were gone. So I was asking about the cluster mailboxes and just what the recommendation will be to the city once the staff makes their presentation this evening or tomorrow evening.
Right. Well, I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I'm saying that this has been a long-standing issue in the Old Town part of the city. The current staff report cites staff reports that go back to 2011, and it looks like it's been an issue that's been sort of pushed out over the years. And my understanding is, first of all, I do want to clarify, I don't think anybody is interested in closing the post office at the city level. Definitely not. I think it's considered a pretty valuable gathering space and really an institution on Main Street. So just to be clear about that, I think the issue is more, is the city willing to change its policy and look at allowing these gang boxes or cluster mailboxes in different parts of Old Town? And there are just such challenges with that, as you probably know, around snow removal and the aesthetics of dealing with the historic district. And and who has responsibility for their maintenance, and it just is a complicating factor. At the same time, the post office certainly has legitimate concerns and has for a long time around dealing with second homes and deliveries and returns and or undeliverable aspects of dealing with second homes. And so we're really just bringing this back to the council for another discussion. It's not an action item per se, and so we really just hope to have a discussion to get people back up to speed and orient them to the latest and greatest issues and see if there's a if there is an interest in going in a different direction from the current direction the city has in terms of place of policy for these boxes.
Yeah, okay. And then there's a $250,000 that was earmarked in this year's budget approval, and staff is asking the city now to decide how to divvy that out. Can you talk about what they're recommending to council?
Yes. Well, we don't have a super specific recommendation yet. The council, as part of their fiscal 21 budget, set aside a decent chunk of funds for business relief, but it was left that sort of broad and vague on purpose, in a large part because we knew that all of these other federal and local and state funds, private sources were kind of coming into play to support businesses. And I think the city really wanted to have some flexibility to fill gaps where those other sources maybe were not going to be available. And we're starting to see how that's playing out with CARES Act funding and some other funding sources starting to end. And so the city can be pretty nimble. We can move pretty quickly. And so this is an initial conversation with the council to get some guidance on their thoughts of how we should approach this. We are thinking as staff, and John Weinhummer's been really leading out on this for the team, that, it makes sense to probably treat this as a grant program, but it's a question of, are we looking at a businesses of maximum of 20 people? Should they be quote unquote essential businesses? Should it target a specific sector or not? And we just really wanted to get some policy guidance from the council before we moved too quickly, as it were, on this program.
So, David, do you have any idea how much federal subsidies our local area businesses have received at this point?
I don't have that off the top of my head. I know there's been some, for sure, but I couldn't say what the dollar amount was.
No. Okay. And what kind of feedback are you getting about this this emergency fund from business owners? Are they giving you feedback about how they think it should be dispersed?
Yeah, we've received some comments back, not a ton, but some that people are saying, a couple that I've seen at least, people are saying, look, don't limit it to one particular type of business, and maybe just make sure it's for businesses that are that haven't seen other sources of grants or loans come their way. Like for whatever reason, they weren't able to access the other ones because they didn't get there. It was a first come, first serve, and there was such a rush to get to these other sources that they weren't able to. So I think there's, some compelling arguments to make these available to businesses that haven't yet been able to receive funds through no fault of their own.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. We're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. Thank you for joining us this morning. Anything else you'd like to say?
I was asked to make sure that I plugged that at noon today, there is going to be a council roundtable on the Zooms with regard to the Arts and Culture District project. So anybody who'd like to see that project, the progress report and where it's going, can join us on Zoom, and all that information is on the city's website.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's David Everett, Deputy City Manager for Park City.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Bye now. It's 8:45. People's Health Clinic board member Diane Pignatelli is on to talk about the 21 years of service the clinic has provided to the Wasatchback communities that are most in need. With the COVID-19, of course, now more than ever, the People's Health Clinic is an essential service for many people here. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Carolyn.
Thanks for joining us. So events and gatherings are getting canceled pretty much left and right. They're postponed or reimagined. And the People's Health Clinic has been serving this community now for 2 decades and then some. And now you're trying to create a celebration of some kind, the Walk for 21. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. Well, as you know, it's been very difficult for nonprofits to come up with creative ideas for their fundraisers. We had a walk and wine, and we also had Healthy Labs. Both we decided as a board to cancel because of safety reasons. So we had to reinvent the fundraiser, and we're calling it Walk for 21, or 21 Cheers for 21 Years. And this is a non-structured walk beginning on August 1st, going until the 21st. We're asking everybody to walk 21 miles in 21 days for a donation of $21 per individual or $75 for a family of four. You can walk anytime you would like with your friends, by yourself, with your dog, and there's no monitoring of the walk. It's just a way to get some exercise, get outside in Park City, enjoy the beautiful weather. At the end of the 21 days, there will be two raffle drawings. Each one will be 6 months at the Silver Mountain Spa, 6 months membership at the spa. And we also have a silent auction going on at the same time with wonderful experiences and gift baskets.
Okay, and are those auction items, are they available to peruse right now?
They are. Okay. You can go on our website, peopleshealthclinic.org.donate, and you can register for the Walk for 21 and also look at the auction items.
Okay, and how much money are you hoping to raise with this event?
Well, that's a good question. This is our only fundraiser, only clinic-sponsored fundraiser this year, and because we've never done it before, we're really not sure. We hope that we can get a lot of participants, and as we're asking $21, we would love it if people would make a larger donation if possible. And then we hope with a silent auction that that will increase our funds.
Okay. And how normally, prior to pandemic times, how would the People's Health Clinic do most of its fundraising?
Well, 38% of the money that goes to the People's Health Clinic is done by our fundraising events. And so we would have Healthy Laughs in the fall, and we would have Walk and Wine in June. And then we also rely on the appeal, the yearly appeal, as well as Live Well in Park City.
Okay. Oh, Live PC, Give PC.
Yeah,
in November.
Live PC, Give PC. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. And of course, all of that is so uncertain how that will evolve, the Live PC, Give PC event. Normally a very, very significant fundraiser for many nonprofits in town. So what are you seeing? What are people seeing at the People's Health Clinic right now? Are there a lot of very sick people coming in? What kind of an environment?
Well, during the COVID crisis, we were doing 70% of our patient visits via telemedicine. We were not opening the clinic very often unless it was absolutely necessary. We have seen an increase in patient encounters, and we also have, this date, we have 75 new patients. We're expecting an uptick in that as people have lost their jobs and have lost their insurance. One of the wonderful things that's happening at the clinic right now is we've been given the go-ahead to do vaccines for children and adults. So we're very happy to be able to do that, and we're finding that is going to be probably take a lot of time for us to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so with 75 new patients, are those mostly from Summit County, or are you serving also the Wasatch community?
Well, we serve the Wasatch County and Summit County. Our service area is 63% Summit County and 36% Wasatch County. So those 75 new patients, I'm really not sure which county they come from.
Mm, okay. I recently read that millions of Americans have lost their health insurance because it's tied to, of course, their jobs. And I'm just wondering, is anyone who does not have health insurance, is anyone able to access this service that the People's Health Clinic provides there?
You have to live in either Summit or Wasatch County. So that would be the only requirement that we would ask of our patients, is to live in those two localities.
Okay. But of course we have, transient workers that come here. Would that also, would they qualify as well?
Yes, they would.
Okay. And anything else that people should know about your event and participating? Sounds like 21 miles in 21 days should be very doable. And if you're not a walker, maybe that's a good way to start your, you know, launching into becoming a walker.
Exactly. Once you register and we begin the walking part of it for the 3 weeks, you will get each day a suggested walk. Again, I'm stressing suggested. Nobody has to do that particular walk. But also there'll be some fitness tips and some walking information. So each day you'll get some encouragement to do that 1 mile or more. Also, the last week in July, when you get your registration materials, everybody will get a buff, a protective scarf with People's Health Clinic logo on it. So that will be fun to identify that you're part of the walk. And then I guess, Carolyn, the final thing I would like to say is the People's Health Clinic is so appreciative of all of the support that the community gave us during the height of the crisis in March and April. We couldn't operate without the support that we received during that time. So we're quite grateful.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you. That is People's Health Clinic board member Diane Pignatelli. Appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thank you, Carolyn.
By now. It's 8:53. Well, Park City's Public Art Advisory Board met on Monday evening to discuss a range of issues like COVID-19's impact on future projects to the updates on current ones. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
Monday was the board's first meeting since March and the first virtual meeting held over Zoom since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. Due to the impacts of the pandemic, the board's budget has been frozen until further notice by City Council and future projects have been put on hold. The Public Art Advisory Board has completed nearly $130,000 worth of projects in Park City since 2018. The board did discuss projects that were completed or in progress since their last meeting, however. The new mural in the Deer Valley Drive Tunnel by Chuck Landvatter garnered particular praise from Board Chair Beth Armstrong.
I normally ride my bike through, and I actually stopped, parked my bike so I could, because I was going too fast. It's really something that needs to be walked because it's extraordinary. It really is fine art. I liked it so much. I find it very emotional. I thought it was great. Well done.
Park City Summit County Arts Council Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder also provided an update on the council's plans for the summer. She says the annual Summit Arts Showcase in Oakley has been postponed due to COVID-19. And a decision will be made on whether a 2020 show is possible later in August. Scudder says the Summit County Fair, which was canceled in June, will not be hosting a public art show either and will be focusing on a digital showcase instead. Scudder says the submission deadline for the show is the end of July, and two local artists will be chosen by members of the Summit County Council to be featured at the county courthouse in Colville.
We also acknowledge that artists are being really impacted by the coronavirus, and so we want to find as many ways as possible to support them and help them sell their artwork.
The discussion around Main Street's temporary social equity murals continued as well. Board member Alex Butwinski expressed a desire to be notified of any future art projects the advisory board is not a part of in the interest of better communication between the board and city government. The temporary murals were a joint project between Park City Municipal and the Park City Summit County Arts Council.
You know, unfortunately, the process part of this has gotten in the way of really focusing on the message. The Arts Council is very nimble and can react very quickly to a short-term request. So for me personally, I probably would have liked an email that it was going to happen, but in terms of a discussion or really being asked my opinion, it probably would have been, yeah, go for it.
The board also discussed the potential removal of the kinetic sculpture at Park City's Mark due to ongoing maintenance and concerns over the fact the sculpture needs human power to operate. Dozens of people would touch the piece per day pre-COVID-19. A decision was made to explore the cost of removal, and an estimated cost for taking down the sculpture will be presented at a future board meeting. The Park City Public Art Advisory Board's next meeting is on August 10th. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
When news breaks, Morning Edition is here for you. Our network of journalists spans the country with microphones in every state. We take you to the places where news is happening. And as things change in your own community and beyond, we'll help you navigate those moments and even prepare you for what might happen next. Listen to Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
Morning, starting at 5 a.m. on KPCW.
Park City Community Foundation is offering congratulations to Holy Cross Ministries. As Rick Bruff reports, that program was chosen this year to receive a $40,000 large impact grant.
J.D. Wright, executive director for the Community Foundation, said the recipient of the grant was chosen by the 1,400 members of the Women's Giving Fund. The CEO of Holy Cross Ministries, Emmy Gardner, said the organization originated with the Catholic Sisters who operated the Holy Cross Hospitals in Salt Lake. When those facilities were sold in the 90s, the sisters stayed on to found a social services organization that helps the most vulnerable sectors of the population, including pregnant mothers, toddlers, and victims of domestic abuse or sexual assault.
You know, we serve clients regardless of their race, religion, or sexual orientation. While we may have kind of a key component in our Latinx community, we serve all immigrant and vulnerable populations. And our vision really is to be distinguished by our unrelenting and adaptive focus on really building and celebrating just, compassionate, sustainable, and inclusive communities.
She said they've been active around the Wasatch Back for about 20 years. Gardner said they're looking forward to making good use of the grant.
Because what we're going to do with the funds is use this to expand our trauma-informed, bilingual, bicultural therapy services. And we're really grateful to People's Health Clinic, one of our partners, because they're allowing housing, office space for us to do those therapy services at the People's Health Clinic so that we can, in essence, create this sort of one-stop shop for many of the clients that Beth's APRN has been referring out in the past. And that can be anywhere from 15 to 20 clients a month.
Katie Wright said there were two other finalists for the grant, the Park City Education Foundation and the Hope Alliance, but they didn't go away empty-handed. The two programs received $20,000 each, thanks to funding from three anonymous donors. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
This economy is not just about the numbers. It's about the people showing up to work every day as well. We will tell you their stories next time on Marketplace.
Weekday afternoons at 6:30 p.m. on KPCW.
It's 8:59, and we are wrapping up our local news hour this morning. Please be aware on Bonanza Drive, it is closed at the Kearns Boulevard intersection. Crews are completing work on the SR-248 transmission waterline improvement project. Plan to use an alternate route. Bonanza Drive will reopen Thursday evening. That's on the 16th. So just beware. And then, get ready for this. Park City Recreation's Adult Kickball League returns August 12th. Competitive and recreation division games are played on Wednesday evenings at the Park City Sports Complex. Grab your team and register at parkcityrecreation.org or call 435-615-5401. Co-ed teams and ages 18 plus are welcome. So sounds like you can do either competitive or recreation. Great options there. Before we bring you back to NPR, let's just give you a quick update on the weather. It's 50 degrees in Park City right now. Sunshine expected this afternoon with a high of 84. And in Heber City, it's 50 degrees. High of 94 expected today. Sunshine through the day. Thanks again for listening to KPCW this morning. We've got next up The Mountain Life, and they'll be coming on just after NPR headlines here. Pete and Lynn's guests are Gary John Bishop and Sue Stewart-Smith. They'll be talking about, Sue will talk about the well-gardened mind and the personal development experts in the industry with Gary Bishop, talking about making changes, how to move past grief.